Good afternoon. So last time we talked about shells generally and things we would do in the shell assignment. We mentioned, in addition to just running commands, a feature that we were particularly interested in was things that manipulate the input and output of programs for run. We learned that on Unix, the convention was we had this array of file descriptors associated with every program, and we figure out what a program's input and output is by the convention that index 0 is the input, index 1 is the output, index 2 is the error output, and so on. And if we want to run a program with different input and output, we can do that by just making those indices point to a different open file when we exec the program. And as for how we would do that, well, we learned that, well, fork just copies all those table entries, so we point to the same open files, and we can change what open files we point to with dupe too. We can assign a particular entry in that table to something we've opened in some other way. We also learned that the way close works is it just assigns a pointer to null. So if we open something, dupe to it, and close the thing we dupe to'd, well, we still have a pointer to it from the dupe to making another pointer. So it doesn't actually go away. That the way that a Unix-like OS actually cleans up open files is when there's no more references to that open file. So you can dupe to it all you want. It still will have resources allocated to it until we're not actually using it from anywhere. Then we talked about one particular special type of file. So we had like these regular files on disk and so on. But the special type of file, which in particular we used to implement the pipeline feature of shells, where we said we wanted to set the output of one program become the input to another. So we have this special type of file called a pipe, which we create with the pipe call. And that gives us a pair of connected file descriptors for that open file. And the idea is we write a value to one of them, and we'll read it from another. And that's where we finish up last time. We'll talk more about that as our next topic, how pipe works. Yes?
So I have a little confusion about close.
Okay.
So when you have like two different duplicates, like the homework we did, or the quiz,
so the question is, what's the argument to close? You pass in one of those array indices, and the close operation is setting that array to null. And a consequence of changing how many pointers we have to an open file is that we might deallocate resources for it.
So it internally keeps track of like all the copies for that one array index?
So question is, internally keeps track of all the copies for that one array index? I'd say that the array index points to an open file, and there might be other array indices pointing to the open file, and the OS keeps track of how many there are across all processes. Does that answer your question? So for our regular files, this maybe isn't so important, right? Because, you know, so what we're, you know, if we have a file on disk, we have to keep track of it anyways because you can open it up at any time. But for things like our pipes, this is actually a big detail because, well, we're going to keep data for that pipe we created, and we want the OS to be able to get rid of it when we're done, but not earlier. And keeping track of how many instances of it being open there are is how the OS is going to do that. Yes?
Somewhat from the quiz, could you explain the process of hanging for wait PID, like how wait PID is done?
Sure. So can I explain? So why don't we can talk about the quiz. Pull up the quiz and open up here. And I have a screen for this. Okay, so this is about wait PID here. So here, wait PID is called twice. So once in the parent process of this first fork, and once in the parent process of this second fork. And in both cases, there is exactly one child process. And wait PID can only wait for a child process. And grandchildren are not child processes. A child of child doesn't count. And wait PID is not going to return until that child process exits. So when we asked, will it hang? The question is, is it going to exit so wait PID has something to return about? And the answer is yes, because the child process either reaches this exit for the or this exit. So that's how we know it does. In fact, it works, it's successful, and doesn't hang. It also turns out, as something that wasn't relevant to this quiz, that if we call wait PID and we have no child processes, wait PID return doesn't hang, it returns an error. It says, I don't have anything to wait for. Yes?
So if you pass a -1 to the wait PID, it's supposed to get all of the children?
So the question is, what does passing -1 to wait PID do?
Oh, no, like, so like once you do pass it in and withdraw all the children, then how do you, what
the question is, when you pass -1 in and it waits for all the children, what return value? So I wouldn't describe -1 in wait PID as wait for all the children. It's wait for any one child. So the OS will wait for the first child that it sees finish or can get the status of for you. And it returns in the return value which one it actually waited for. Yes? The question is, we can only wait for a child, we can't wait for a grandchild. Yes, there's no POSIX, the sort of standard Unix design, provides no way of waiting for something other than your child process. Yes, in practice, there are ways of doing that, but there's ways you do that that look kind of like wait are very OS specific. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Sure.
So if you have a redirection for like output, and then you also have it, you know, typing its output to apply it down the line.
Yeah.
What should happen?
So the question is, what should happen if we have both a redirection and piping at the same time? And right. So if you look at the. Where is my cursor? There it is. Okay. So if you look at the description of how to run commands, which was where? Under here, right. Description of to run a command, we mentioned this scenario explicitly. I'm not gonna test the variants of this that don't make sense to do, but I mentioned what should happen and what would happen with a shell on Unix. Does that answer your question? So we say you do both of them, and you do them in a particular, you do the pipeline first, so it gets overwritten by the redirect.
Yeah, so that's kind of into my second question, but like, well, I think you answered that by saying that if you're not going to test it, then it'll make sense. But like, let's say it caused an error where like you're outputting to the text file, but then you have something that's going to like read from the pipe, would that.
So the question is, what's going to happen when we try to read from a pipe that doesn't have anything writing to it? And that behavior is well-defined. We're going to read nothing. We're going to read end of file. So yeah, the program is probably not going to execute the way you expect, but it is, you know, it's not going to crash. Most likely, it's just going to get, it's going to be as if the program outputted nothing. Okay. Other questions? Yes. In this case, bar's input would be an empty file. Yes?
So the order of operations is pipe first and then redirect?
The question, the order of operations is pipe first then redirects? Yes. Yeah, I'm not planning on testing it, but because people ask about it, I do actually specify it. And also, this is how, you know, real Unix systems do it. So if you like run that on your shell, that's what will happen. Okay. Other questions? Yes. Which question? Question one. Okay. So question one on the quiz. So we have some local variables and some global variables, and the key thing is that that's kind of a red herring, that when we do a fork, we copy everything. We copy all the global variables, all the local variables. So we have two versions of them that are independent of each other after the fork. And that's where all the outputting happens. So after the fork, we're not going to hit this abort case because we have a valid parent and child. And the parent, well, a PID is positive there, so we're just going to write out what global pointer points to, which is the character A, and the X, which points to the character, which is the character A. So we're going to write out A and the parent. And what the child does can't affect that, because that's the parent's memory. It has its own copy. In the child, we're going to call anchor global, which is going to add 1 to global pointer, which points to this lowercase a. So that's going to turn it into B, the way, because of the way ASCII works, A and B are right next to each other. Then we're going to make that point to the capital A, and we're going to increment that to a capital B. And then we're going to output that capital B and the lowercase b. So the parent is going to output lowercase a. The child's going to output uppercase b. And we don't know exactly when the OS will run the parent and child. And that's going to determine what our input is. So our input is going to be A from the parent, capital B, lowercase b from the child. But we don't know how they're going to be interleaved because it depends when the OS switches to the parent and child. And that gives us our first two answers as possibilities. And there's a few more. But for example, C isn't possible because that would imply that AA is not being output by the parent. And the same thing with D. Yes? So what question? The parent can run, but the output is can be mixed up with the child process? Yes. And the reason is just that when the parent's running gets to here, the OS might say, oh, you ran for too long, let me switch to something else, and that something else could be the child process. And that could happen at any time. Or there could be other things on the machine to like slow down when the parent gets to run. So we don't know exactly when the parent and child will run, so we could have all the possible interleavings, depending on what else is going on in the system and how fast things run, and so on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so. So one note, so I had some anonymous feedback correctly pointing out that I updated the schedule without updating the reading. So those readings for last Thursday were confusingly about the topic we're going to start today. And I'll try to avoid that in the future. Let me know if that happens, that sometimes I move things around in the schedule without realizing, oh, wait a moment, I need to move the reading to the day we're actually covering it. Okay, so last time we finished up talking about pipes. We mentioned, you know, sort of the basics of pipes. You can write from one, read from another. So, since we know how pipes work, let's look at this example here. So this is some code, which we make a pipe. And in our child process, we close the read end of the pipe. And in the parent, we close the write end. So I'm going to be trying to give you examples of not having file descriptors open we aren't using, because if we keep doing that, we'll run out. There's also some other reason with pipes, which is that if we don't close the write end of the pipe, then if we ask to read from the pipe, the OS will never tell us the pipe doesn't have anything left, because something could write to it, even if that someone is us. And we're, of course, executing code that would do that. So we close the read and close the write, which we're not using, and we write the character A in the child, and we try to read A in the parent, and read returns how many bytes for array. And we would expect 1. When you run this code, it will consistently output read 0 bytes instead of read 1 byte. So what happened here? You time to look it over. You can check with your neighbors. Anyone have some idea of what might be going wrong here? Yes?
The reference to C is not transferred to the parent.
So you're concerned that we have two clearly different C's here, and you think like we're transferring like a pointer. So the way write works, it's going to read that many bytes and copy it somewhere. So we don't have to worry about like sharing memory or references going away or anything like that. So write, just like when we write to like the terminal, it's going to copy that data elsewhere. So we can change our C afterwards, and it's no problem. Yes. Okay, so your concern is, oh, we try to run the parent process first, and there happens to be nothing in the pipe. So that's a great idea. Like, it seems like, oh, if the child hasn't written yet, maybe we should return zero. So the way read works is that if there is nothing available yet, it waits until either something is available or it knows nothing can be available. If something's available, return that. So that's not going to be what happens here, because read will not return zero when there might be something written. But that's a reasonable idea, but yeah, the details of how read work mean that that's not a possible way to have this problem. Anyone else? Yeah?
You're calling pipe after forking, so the parent and the child are working with completely different pipes?
Yes, so the problem is we're calling pipe twice. So we're creating two different pipes. We have a pipe in the parent and a pipe in the child. So we have our parent running, we fork off our child, we create pipe number one and pipe number two. And the child tries to write to pipe number two, the parent tries to read from pipe number one, and well, of course, you can't get the data from the other pipe. So the fix for this problem would be that we would want to move our call to pipe before the fork. So we have one pipe that's shared between the parent and the child. And I'm mentioning this particular problem because this is a surprisingly common issue on the homework. And understandably tricky to figure out. Questions on issue with multiple pipes? Okay, so one other thing with pipes. So talk about this. So here's an example without forking, and this code doesn't terminate. So what we do here is I make a pipe, I get my read and write end, I write to the write end and read from the read end, and typically this will hang. And what's going on is that a way that pipes work is that they have some storage for data that's been written but not read yet. But they don't have infinite storage. So depending on how big this big size is, the pipe won't write things immediately. That doesn't mean you can't write that. What will happen is the write will wait for someone to read it. And once enough space is freed up by the reading, the write will succeed. So if we're thinking about how we're running our shell commands, this is not actually a problem. This means that if I have command A being piped to command B, if command A tries to write stuff and command B hasn't read it yet, command A hangs until command B reads it, which is probably actually what we want. But it means that code like this, where you might think you're being clever and using pipes, doesn't really work because pipes don't have that much storage. And it makes sense that they don't, because, you know, you don't want your OS like wasting multiple gigabytes of memory for something like this, rather than pausing the things that are filling up the pipe. So questions on how this blocks? Yeah. Why does it not terminate? So the call to write is going to be looking for enough space to put that data. and it won't be there, so it's going to wait until there is space, but there will never be space because no one ever reads it to fill, free up space. Does that answer your question? So if we're thinking about our typical A pipe to B, this isn't a problem because B is going to call read to free up space. So we want to, this won't ever hang indefinitely. Okay, so that's on here. Now let's do a different exercise. So here, I have some code that uses pipe again. And in my child process, I again close the read end. And the parent, I close the write end. And in the child, I write 0, then 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, and so on, up to 9. And in the parent, I read, ask to read 10 bytes, and I print out what I read. So my question is, what are the possible outputs? And let's assume everything doesn't fail, like I'm not out of memory, so 4 crashes. That's not an issue. And you can check with your neighbors, give you a minute. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, who thinks B? C? Okay, D? E? Okay, F? Okay, so we have a lot of people who think either we're gonna get everything or we're going to get either everything or nothing. So the correct answer is A and B. And in fact, there's a few more possible outputs. So I ran this program a whole bunch of times, and I recorded sort of the number of times and the actual output. So let's start with, why isn't nothing possible? So it seems like that maybe the child starts running, and the child gets to here, and the parent just goes and calls read, and it should get nothing because nothing's been written yet. So the way read works is read always waits for some input P to be available or end of file. And end of file for a pipe means no one is able to write to the pipe anymore. So nothing is not possible. We will always get some input. So if we get to this read early, this will wait for some input to be available. So we'll wait for some input, or end of file. Or end of file, which equals no one can write. There's no way to write to the pipe anymore. So because of that, we're always going to get something. But the policy for read is that it returns what's available now for a pipe. It doesn't wait for the whole amount you requested to be available. And the same is true for like reading from a terminal or a network. So when read returns zero, always means end of file. So if no input's available, read does something else. And if less than requested is available, read will give you that. And if you think of like a terminal, this makes a lot of sense, right? If you ask to read, you know, 100 characters, you want to get what's been typed in already, probably. You mean it's less than that. And you like not to have to like read character by character to avoid that sort of issue. So, but this is the policy choice deposit people made because they felt this was a convenient interface. So that's how read works. And that means that's why we can get, you know, everything, which means that when we called, by the time we called read, all 10 of the writes happened, or you can get subsets of it, which is just that only some of the writes happened. And it happens that the pipe will store the data for multiple writes. It has enough space for that. It doesn't have infinite space, as I mentioned, but it has enough for 10 characters, at least. And typically enough for like half a kilobyte or something like that. Some questions about this example. Okay, so that's on read. So read returns less than available. So this means that if you actually want to read like a kilobyte, you need code like this, where you check the return value of read and see where you are in the buffer to get up to that amount of space. You can't actually just call read with 1024 from something like a network or a pipe and expect to get that all the time. So it's on read and write. Okay, so one final thing. So I mentioned on pipes, I'd like to mention again. So if all write ends of a pipe are closed, you can get end of file. If they aren't, you can't. And this includes if you have the write end of the pipe closed and you're reading from it, as we saw in that example of a hang, right? That when we looked at here, like there's, I can tell there's no possible way that that pipe's being written to. But the rule is that read is going to wait, sorry, but the rule is that that's not end of file. That sort of situation is not end of file. This is not, yes, not an example of that. But the rule for when you get end of file on a pipe is that no one can write to it, meaning there's no open write ends of the pipe, even if it's one that in the process that or thread that's reading from it. And this what isn't a problem in other things we've seen. Exit closes things, so you don't need to worry about like closing things on exit. But this is why all the code I showed closes the write end when we're not using it. If we don't do that, and something's expecting to read everything on the pipe, well, as long as one of those write ends is open, read's always going to say, oh, there might be more data, let me wait for it. But if we close them, read will eventually say, oh, no more data, I'm going to return zero because no one can write to this. And you saw in my code examples, I was closing the read end of pipes. And I probably didn't really need to do that, but it's a very good habit to close file descriptors that aren't being used because you have a limited number of them. And in particular for shell, if you don't close them, they're inherited by exec, which means that you might limit the number of file descriptors, the things you run have to use if you use extra ones and don't close them. And you would be probably pretty annoying if you sat down in the shell and it read all your programs so they could like only open up half the number of files they should be able to. Maybe avoid that. Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish up talking about sort of the file API in Unix. Questions before I move on to our next topic, sort of about scheduling and processes. So we're going to look at how XV6 runs threads, decides how to switch the threads, and manages them. And we looked at this a little before. We mentioned that there were these process control blocks that are kind of mingled with the thread control blocks. But I showed you the struct for a process. I didn't say where those were stored. So XV6 has this thing they call the process table, which is an array of process control blocks. It's a fixed size. You might say, what if I want to run more programs than nproc? The XV6 solution is, well, you're out of luck. Sorry, you can't do that. Obviously, on a more production OS, we might have to do some like malloc or something like that. XV6 decided to keep things simple and just say, if you want to run more than nproc, you change the number and recompile. And there's this lock. So we'll learn more about locks later when we talk about multi-threaded programming. The purpose of this from a high level is that we don't want more than one thing to access the table of processes at a time, so we don't have problems. And the rule we're going to follow is we don't change or check the state of a process without acquiring the lock, and we release the lock when we're done. And we'll see that in the code I'm going to show you. And we'll talk about how locks work in a few weeks, which will make this make more sense. But for now, we just have this rule we follow, and I promise you the lock is going to keep us from having two things run at the same time. So either on multiple cores or on the same core, it will keep us from having like an exception happen and we modify the process table because an exception happened while we were doing something with it. The locks will prevent that from happening. Because if we didn't, it would be really confusing to see what's going on. So we have this lock and we have this process table. So I might say, how do we allocate something in there? So we just scan it to find something that's marked as unused. So every process has a state. The unused state is free. When XV6 wants to assign a new one, it looks for the first unused one. You might say this seems very inefficient. Yep, sure is. You might imagine better data structures for finding this than just scanning it every time. And there's one thing we should talk about, which is starting the first process. So I told you about, fork. Fork creates a new process, but we need an existing one. We talked about running programs, exec runs a program, but we need a process that's already running a program. So how does XV6 start the first program in the first process? And the code for that is in userInit. So userInit calls this alecproc function, which finds a process control block that's free and sets up the kernel stack and things like that. And it loads this hard-coded program. So this initUVM function loads into that process's memory a program that's hard-coded in the XV6 kernel. And what the program does is it just runs an execv system call of /init. So then there's this /init program that's included in XV6. That's the program that you actually see like run a shell for you. This is sort of just the bootstrapping, and in addition to loading the code, they need to set up an initial PC and stack pointer to make that code be able to run, just to run that system call. And they mark it as runnable. We'll see what this is used for in a bit. So questions about our setup, the first process stuff. So we have this sort of special case. We just run this program called init. We just have code hard-coded just to do the minimum of just executing it in the current process. That's how we set up our first process. Okay, so that's about making the first process. So we're going to talk about how we run threads in XV6. And in XV6, threads and processes are the same. But our textbooks like talk about thread scheduling, and that's how we're going to be viewing things. And remember we talked about, we have threads are the things that gets run on the CPU. We have like our registers and our program counter, but we have like information about like what the files are open, which is part of the process. And in XV6, I mentioned these are all stored together. So we have part of our process control block is what would be a separate thread control block in other OSs. But in XV6, since each process has exactly one thread, and no threads run outside of a process, they're the same thing. But on a more featureful OS, we'd have multi-threaded processes. So we'd have some processes which had multiple threads, where each thread had its own program counter, its own registers, its own stack. And the threads in a process all share the same open files, the same process ID, the same memory other than their stack. That would be what we typically expect. And we're going to talk about scheduling threads. And when we think about scheduling threads, for now, we're just basically going to be treating threads all the same, no matter what process they belong to. So we're going to decide which thread to run when. And as far as we're concerned in making that decision, we're choosing between this, 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 and this. We're not choosing a process first. We're just choosing a thread. Questions about that idea? So we're looking at threads too. And to start talking about running, how we run threads, when we run them, we're going to talk about the states a thread goes to. So we've talked about doing context switches, but we have more information to manage because sort of doing a context switch assumes, oh, we can run this thread now, and also that we've chosen it. But we have some other cases where threads can be where we can't run them. And in XV6, this information is represented by the state variable in the process control block. And I also have sort of our more generic names you might see in our textbook. So we have this new state. So when we're creating a thread, when we've allocated it but not started it, in XV6, this is marked as in the embryo state, and I've marked it new on this diagram. So we have something that's not ready to run yet. We're setting it up. And then it becomes what we call ready, or XV6 calls runnable. This is something we could put on the CPU. So it's ready, we can run it on the CPU, but it's currently inactive. It currently has its register saved in memory, but we could switch to them and run it right now. And at some point, it will actually be on the CPU, what we call running. And as shown in this diagram, sometimes something can be on the CPU, and even though we could keep running it, we'll stop running it, and we'll send it back to this ready state. Sometimes something will be on the CPU and it will be waiting for something to happen, like waiting for a key press, waiting for a certain amount of time to pass. That's what this waiting state, or what XV6 calls sleeping, is for. And note that this sleeping, as far as XV6 is concerned, includes things like waiting for a key press. That they call that sleeping. We also have this finish state, which XV6 marks as zombie. So you might say, why doesn't the thread just go away? So if we think of how the Unix API, remember I could call wait PID on a program that had terminated and get its status code, which means we have to reserve the process ID and store the information about that program that hasn't been waited for. XV6 uses the zombie state to do that. So they keep the process control block around and allocate it until it's waited for in that finish / zombie state. Yes?
So this would only clear that state when we call wait PID?
So we'd only clear that state when we call wait PID? So yes, but there's special handling for if a parent process exits before waiting for its children. That answer your question? Yes? So the question is, when would these transitions happen? So we'll go through some examples. So ready to runnable is that something else stopped running for some reason, and we chose this thing as the thing to run next. Running to ready is something most commonly is like a timer interrupt. We decided it ran for too long, we're going to run something else now. And running to waiting is something like if you call the read system call and there's not input available for you yet, that's the state we'll use to manage that. Does that answer your question?
Like, what would cause a thread that is currently running, what would cause it to go from running to ready versus going from running to waiting?
So the question, what's the difference between going from running to ready, running to waiting? So something that's in the waiting state is something that even if we really wanted to run it, it's not capable of running right now. So an example is if your program's waiting for a key press, there's nothing you can accomplish by starting it. versus if it's in ready, if you start it, it will actually do something potentially useful. Does that answer your question? So basically, things that are in the waiting state, we never want to switch to, because they can't do anything useful. Things in the ready state presumably can. Yes?
Is it more common for something that's in the sleeping state to move to the ready state and stay there, or move from sleeping to runnable, and then immediately move into run?
So the question is it more common for something that's waiting to move to ready for a while versus moving from ready to running very quickly? And this is a policy question. So we'll see that in XV6 doesn't do anything to speed that up. So there, it depends on what other things are runnable, how fast that will happen. On other systems, we're making a more informed policy choice. We might try to make that process faster. And we'll learn about sort of what would make you design an OS that way versus other ways. When we talk, probably mostly next time. Did I answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So this view here is sort of saying what happens to a single process. We can also have sort of a system-wide view of the same procedure, and we can kind of view us as having these queues of processes. And these queues are going to be more like sort of priority queues than just first come, first serve sort of queues that you would have implemented in a data structures course. So I have a queue called the ready queue here, which is my list of things that I could run on the CPU. When things finish running on the CPU, sometimes they go back onto the ready queue. We can run them again. Sometimes they go on one of these IO queues to like wait for a key press or something like that. And in many OSs, these queues of threads would actually be represented by something like a queue or a priority queue data structure. XV6 doesn't do that. XV6 has made the decision to, you know, represent them as just things in that process table, and you have to scan to find them. But if we have this at least conceptual queue, we can say, you know, we have this interesting question of what do we run from the ready queue. We have this queue, how should it be ordered? What should we take off it? We're going to talk a bunch about that question as sort of our main exploration into what we call scheduling. So in XV6, as I mentioned, XV6 doesn't actually have explicit queues. So there's what we call the ready queue in XV6 is all the processes in the process table that are marked as runnable. And when XV6 wants to find something on the ready queue, it scans the entire process table for things that are marked as runnable. Yes, this is inefficient. That's how XV6 works. And same thing for IO queues. When XV6 wants to find things that are waiting for a key press, it scans for things that are marked as sleeping with the chan variable set to indicate the keyboard. In a OS that was more concerned with performance then simplicity, probably we'd have separate lists of these, so these lookups would be a lot faster than scanning a list. So we're going to talk about scheduling in the context of CPU. And scheduling is basically when we have these queues, be they queues of threads running to use a CPU, queues of things waiting to use an I/O device like a network, what do we run when? We're going to talk about it just for the ready queue in front of a CPU. In fact, it's going to be more focused than that. But I want to mention that there's these other types of scheduling, and a lot of the things we'll learn apply to them too. But we're going to focus on the CPU scheduling problem because it's well explored. We have a concrete example of how it works in XV6. And because, the basic principles will apply to a lot of other scheduling problems. But for example, there's other scheduling problems like batch job scheduling. So if we think of supercomputers, if I'm running big computations like weather simulations, I have to decide which one to run, that's a very different problem than deciding what to run on my laptop or desktop. Because these things are running for days or hours. And context switching might be a lot more complicated because we have to save stuff to disk. If I'm deciding when to send stuff all on the network, that's a very different problem. It's still a scheduling problem. I still have to decide, do I send program A's output first or program B's? Still a scheduling problem. You can have some of the same things, but it's different. We're going to target CPU scheduling And not just CPU scheduling. We're going to target a very specific kind of CPU scheduling. We're talking CPU scheduling where our programs are doing lots of I/O. So if you think of your typical laptop or desktop, you know, things are waiting for key presses and waiting for network inputs. That's the sort of scenario we're going to look at. And there are other programs that can use the processor when those other programs are doing I/O. So when we do I/O, our assumption is something else can use the processor right now. And we're going to assume there's only a single CPU. This is probably, these days, the most unrealistic of these assumptions. So we're working with a single core. And there's a bunch of things you'd have to do to make multi-core work well that we're going to just not handle. And at some point, we're going to get to talking about a scheduling policy. So the policy is the decision we make about what to remove from the queue. And want to mention this concept. So a policy should be based on, like, what do we want to achieve? What goals do we have? And we're going to look at what XV6 does in detail in its scheduler next. I want you to think about what policy does XV6 has, because it looks like it doesn't have any. You're going to look at the scheduler code. There's no code that seems to be making decisions. Like, everything that happens seems to just be an accident. But there is a policy that's kind sort of accidentally embodied in the code. And we're going to think about, is that the best policy? And the answer is going to be sometimes. And we're going to think about what other possibly better policies would be. So to talk about how XV6 makes this decision about what to remove from the queue, what runnable thing to run next, I'm going to go back to our context switch. And I showed you this diagram of our context switch. I said, oh, sometimes our program is running, an exception happens, like a timer interrupt or a system call, and we decide to switch to another program. So we switch to another program, then our program finishes running in kernel mode and returns back to the other application. So this diagram was a bit simplified. So what really happens is that we have a switch to a scheduler thread. So there's this scheduler function that runs in a separate thread that we switch to, and that separate thread has its own stack, and it decides what to switch to next, and it's what switches to application B. So this is the design XV6 chose. It's not the only way of doing this. Probably, in fact, not the most efficient way, but they just did it for simplicity. The big advantage for them is that this scheduler function can have local variables that are preserved in between switches to it. Okay. So we have the scheduler function. It's what's actually switching to the next thing. So let's look at the code for our scheduler function. So our scheduler function runs an infinite loop. And in that infinite loop, it locks the process table so no one else uses it, and iterates to find all the runnable processes in the table. And each time it finds one, it switches to it. So we switch to it, and then that program switches back to us, back to the scheduler thread. It goes to the next iteration of this loop until it finds something. If it doesn't find any remaining processes in the table, it goes back to the beginning. So what our scheduler here does is it just finds the next runnable thing. If there's no more runnable things, go back to the beginning, find the first runnable thing. And just keep doing that indefinitely. Yes? So the question isn't there a problem here with locking the P table, because doesn't that mean the thing we switched to can't use the process table? So the thing we switched to is going to unlock the process table. We're going to have this policy that while we're doing scheduling stuff, we have the process table locked. When we're done doing scheduling stuff and are back to running a program normally, we're going to unlock it. But the code to unlock it needs to be somewhere else. So it's going to be in the things that switch to and from the scheduler thread. Does that answer your question?
So when all our homeworks
and stuff, you have to specifically unlock it? You will not be rewriting the code that switches to or from the scheduler thread in our upcoming homework. We'll have homework. We're going to change the scheduler function, but you shouldn't need to change the functions that switch to it. But you're going to observe right now that this policy, this code here, it's really simple and maybe not making the best choice. We're going to try to make a different choice. in our upcoming lottery honk. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I've omitted some of the code that's around this switch here. So I'm gonna show it since it will come up. So the scheduler does some bookkeeping around the switch. So one thing we do is we mark the current process as being run. And this, remember, we saw myproc in our system call code. This is what makes myproc work. So before we switch to something, we set myproc. And also at the bottom, we set it so myproc returns null when we're not running anything. So the scheduler handles that operation before it switches. We also have to do some other bookkeeping. So switch UVM, this changes the address space of a program. So it makes it so the memory that's active is the one for the program we're switching to. And we also set it as running. So we know it's not just runnable, it's running. We don't want to switch to it again. So XV6 supports multiple cores. So we really don't want it to be the case that one core decides to run something and the other core decides to run the same thing at the same time. That's not going to work. So you mark it as running so no one else tries to run it. Then we have our actual switch. And we'll see the code that this switches to in a bit. And after we're done, there's the switch KVM. This sets the address space back to away from the user process, so it clears the address space for just only kernel stuff being available. Okay, so questions about the details of our context switch here? Okay, so that's our, and now I have a little more detailed version of our scheduler code. So I mentioned that we had these calls to switch, that switch to the scheduler function. And we learned when we talked, someone asked about, well, what about this process table lock? We have to do some stuff with that. So these calls, there's some things they have to do. And most of these calls go through a function called sched, S-C-H-E-D. And the sched function, it has a little extra code, but essentially the sched function just calls switch. That's all it does. It has a little extra bookkeeping and error checking, but it's just calls switch to the scheduler thread. So we're going to look at the code that actually switches to the thread. And I'm going to start with the example of the function yield. So yield, we saw very briefly when we talked about timer interrupts. So in the trap function, when there's a timer interrupt, it calls yield to switch to another program. So that's all the yield function does. So let's look at what the yield function, how the yield function is implemented. So the yield function is handling the case of our program is running and we want to switch to something else. And later on, we're going to be switched back to. So it handles these two highlighted arrows here. When we enter the function, we're transitioning from running to ready. When we leave the function, we're transitioning from ready to running. So the first thing we do is we acquire the process table lock. Because remember that rule that I never, you know, manipulate the process states without holding that. Also, the scheduler is going to expect me to always have the process table lock when I switch to it, because it's going to be working through the process table information. So I acquire the process table lock, then I set the current process as runnable, because we're no longer going to be running it. But I want to let the scheduler know that it can run it again if it wants. And then I call this function sched, which, as I said, basically just contains the call to switch. So we're going to call, make that call to sched. And the scheduler is going to be back in its loop. And it's going to go to the next thing in the loop until it finds another process to run. If it doesn't find any, it's going to go back to the beginning. Okay, so questions about our first part of yield. So eventually, the scheduler is going to come back around to the same process, which probably will still be runnable. So in that case, it's going to switch back. So we'll call switch. That will return from the SCED call and go back to the bottom of yield, and we'll finish yield and go back to our original program where we decided to switch away earlier. Some questions about transitions in yield. So I guess I should point out that we release the process table lock before we return because we know it was held as part of the scheduler doing its work, and we don't want it held so other things can manipulate processes while we're running our normal program. Questions? Yield. Okay, so that's about the yield function. So that handles the transitions between ready and runnable. But there's one sort of special case for ready to runnable running that has to deal with this new case. When we're starting a new process, XP6 does that a little differently. And when we talked about creating a new thread, I mentioned briefly that we sort of set up this stack which had switch returning to somewhere. And the somewhere it had switch returning to is a function called forkRed. So that should now make a little more sense. ForkRed is the return part of fork. So this is what's used after we create a new process. It turns out XP6 doesn't copy the kernel stack, it makes a new one. And it sets it up to return to this forkRed function after the scheduler thread switches to it. And the forkRed function, our new process becomes ready. We start running it, and we're going to switch back to it, and it's going to release that process table lock and then start running the program from the fork return. Okay, so questions about forkRed. So this forkRed call to switch is set up as part of our creating a new thread. And this is the one case where we actually run the scheduler as if without calling the SCED because of how we set up the thread. Okay, so there's one more transition I haven't talked about, and that's that waiting state. And XP6 calls this sleep. I know that's a bit confusing because you might be used to sleep as wait for a certain amount of time. And XP6 sleep is, in the kernel, is what's used to wait for any sort of event. So there's a function called sleep, which handles the transition from running to waiting. So what it does is it gets this chan, for channel, I assume, which is what we're waiting for. So like there's a value of this that represents the keyboard, and there's values for other devices or things we want to wait for. And we mark the current process as sleeping, and we mark what it's sleeping on, so what it's waiting for, and then we go to the scheduler. And the scheduler goes to its loop, and unless something happens to our process, well, the scheduler's never going to run it because we're marked as sleeping. Sleeping is not runnable. So something else is going to happen at some point, probably in response to an exception of some sort, that's going to change that sleeping value to something that's not sleeping. And the function that does this is wakeUp1. And wakeUp1 looks for something with a particular channel. So I mentioned there's going to be a value for like the keyboard. It scans the process list for something that's marked as sleeping and waiting on that particular channel and marks it as runnable. So two notes here. So one is that XV6 has decided to keep things simple. We're not going to like have an efficient data structure to do this lookup. But as you would imagine, a more production OS, you probably would want to not do a linear search for this. Another thing you'll notice is that we don't actually switch to the program right away. All we do is mark it as runnable, and later on, you know, the scheduler is going to run, and it's going to switch to it. And you could say, is this a good choice? Well, it depends what you want to optimize for, but this is XP6's design decision, is that they don't do anything special to prioritize something that just woke up, even though you might intuitively say, maybe that seems like a good idea. And for certain ideas, for certain goals you might have, it certainly is. But all XP6 does is mark it as runnable and says, the scheduler will eventually go through its loop and find it again and run it. So questions about our wakeUp function. So we've seen that x86 scheduler makes some odd choices. We have a separate scheduler thread, which not everyone does. In fact, most OSs don't do. The convenience is, well, we have stuff in the stack in our scheduler thread. So if we look at our scheduler function, right, we have this variable p here. That's a local variable that's going to be on the stack. That's nice and convenient. If we didn't have a separate thread, we need to somehow manage that without having it be a local variable. We also always scan the process list. So that keeps things simple as far as our data structures, but it means that it's a lot less efficient than it could be. You know, it'd be really nice when a key press happens that we don't scan the list of processes for things that are waiting for a key press, we just have a pointer to it. And other OSs will do that. Another thing is that the policy, the choice of what program to run when, is very tightly coupled with how we manage the state of processes. That it's just based on how that array is organized, rather than being a decision based on some sort of cohesive goals. So if we're thinking about the policy that x86 has for scheduling, what runnable program do we run? The first, whatever's next in the list, not even the first one, whatever's next in the list. And is that the best answer? Well, it depends what we should care about. So we're going to look at, as our next topic, you know, what could we care about and what sort of policies would do well, good or bad, including the policy x86 has chosen. And to talk about this, I'm going to talk about this in terms of some simplifying assumptions from the same vintage as x86. So we're going to assume one program per user. To keep things simple, one thread per program. And the programs are independent. So if you think of like we have like program A piped to program B, probably we'd actually want to decide when to run A and B based on the knowing that, you know, running A will help us run B. I'm going to ignore that problem. Assume all the programs are independent. I'm going to assume there's one program per user. So, you know, if I have two different programs and I want to be fair to all users, I run them equally, even though, you know, in a real system, that's often not really the case, just to keep things simple. And I'm just going to deal with our ready. And with this idea in mind, I'm going to have a particular model of how programs behave. And I'm going to say that programs, they do some computation, followed by some I/O, followed by some computation, followed by some I/O. And they have what we'll call CPU bursts and I/O bursts that are alternating. So we think of a shell. It waits for a key press. After I press a bunch of keys, it does a bunch of work, and then waits for something else to happen. Now I think of a drawing program. It waits for me to press my mouse or my tablet pen, does some work, then waits for something else to happen. If I think of a web browser, it waits for a remote web server or me to press something. So we have these sort of loops where it's alternating between doing a bunch of work and waiting for you. This is going to be our model of how programs behave. And under this model, our goal in CPU scheduling is to schedule these CPU bursts, these little bits of work that we might have multiple programs trying to do. You know, something just came in on the network, I just pressed something, what do I run first? You know, or if we're thinking of like Portal, you know, 25 different people just type something into the SSH server, which one goes first? You know, that's the problem that the scheduler is designing. We want to figure out what's the best policy for that. And a useful thing to know is, well, if we have these bursts of CPU, how long are they? What do they look like? Are they consistently like all the same size? Do they take minutes? Do they take very short amounts of time? And we can measure this. And people have measured this a bunch of times. So here are some measurements from 1966. And these measurements are in compute ticks, which as pointed out here are about 15 milliseconds. And we can see that most of the time between this was measuring from that user typing something to waiting for the next thing to be typed, was about 30 milliseconds, with some outliers into the seconds to hundreds of seconds, you know, tens of seconds range. So that's sort of typical for a 1966 interactive system. You might say, it's been a while since 1966. Maybe things are different. Probably. But let's look at some data from 1990, so 25 years later. So note that this is a log scale, and these are buckets here. And we can see there's sort of the typical amount of time is like 1 to 16 milliseconds. It hasn't actually changed that much. The sort of length of these typical CPU bursts on a system that people are like using personally. And these are the things we're going to schedule, these units of work that are these lengths of time. So most of the things that programs want to do is going to, the program wants to run for, 4 to 10 milliseconds to handle some input. And that's the sort of thing we're going to schedule when we have multiple programs we could run at a time. And we also, of course, have some things that want to run for a very long time. Like your compiler, for that compile that takes forever, that long weather simulation. But those are not the common case, and not what we're going to be focused on. So we have this model where we have these CPU bursts, which are typically pretty short, alternating with possibly short I/O bursts, possibly longer I/O bursts, depending on what sort of I/O we're doing. And that's what we're going to be concerned with scheduling. And so our view is our ready queue is going to have a list of all the CPU bursts that are ready to run, and our goal is to decide which one we want to run first. And we're going to solve that scheduling problem. And to think about this, I mentioned we have a policy decision. So we already know how to schedule things. We just choose something to run. We saw XP6 does that. It just chooses the next thing to run. But we want to make a decision that's better, or at least know how good our decision is. And to do that, we have to decide how to measure things. And there's a bunch of metrics we can choose from. And I'm going to talk about these sort of three mainly. We'll have one more that will make a guest appearance later. So one is what we'll call turnaround time. So this is the time from when I press a key to when I see my response, to when I get my response. So if I think of running a command, until that command like shows me its output, or like pressing a button in the web browser till the web browser actually does something about that and does whatever the button press should have done. We'll call that turnaround time. Sometimes it's also called response time. We'll also talk about throughput. So throughput is just efficiency. So if I'm thinking of like Portal, I just don't want to waste all my time switching between programs. I don't want to spend 10 minutes making a decision about what's the best program to run next, even if that optimizes my turnaround time, because my system won't be able to get anything done. And we have this sort of third, more nebulous idea of fairness, that if I think of a system like our department machines that are shared between lots of users, I want to treat each user equally. Or maybe I have a different notion of equal, like I want to make sure the important users get what they deserve and the unimportant users get what they deserve. But I have some idea of something we'll broadly call fairness that I want to provide. And I want to do that even if it means my system has lower throughput, that it's less efficient, that I'm like maybe spending more time switching between programs than I should or doing bookkeeping. Or if it means I'm less efficient in terms of turnaround time, even if it, I don't want to give you instantaneous responses if it means that I'm going to be giving some other user a lot less good response time. So I have that notion. And we'll learn that these goals are going to be kind of in conflict, that we want different policies to achieve all these two goals. And often we want to achieve some sort of mix between these goals, and we'll have to mix those policies together, and it won't be perfect on either of these metrics. We'll have to come up with something else. Questions about these scheduling metrics? Okay, so we have these scheduling metrics, and and we're going to look at as a turnaround time. So we're thinking of CPU bursts. We can think of turnaround time as kind of time to start the next input or output operation. So if you like think of, I press a button in the web browser, how long is it until the web browser is waiting for my next button press? So that is sort of the thing we're going to look at. And that's sort of the natural thing if we're talking about, you know, doing interactive stuff. Let's look at sort of measuring these concretely. Just briefly, we'll fix this up next time. So let's look at throughput. Throughput, we'll talk as useful work done per unit time. And our main issue with throughput is that context switches take time, or have, if they don't take time directly, they cause things to run slower. And we want to minimize that time. So the conflict here is going to be that, well, a lot of the policies we have, we might want to like precisely optimize what's running now. Well, that's going to hurt throughput, because we're going to be switching to do that. And typically, we'll measure throughput as sort of a percentage of the actual processor we got for useful stuff. So running the scheduler, doing context switches, not useful in term for this purpose, versus overhead, which is what we'll call running the scheduler and so on. We also talk about fairness. So fairness, in some cases, is easy. So which one of these is more fair? Thinks the first one is more, second one. Yeah, so this case is intuitive. What's tricky about fairness is that the corner cases are really hard to figure out. So it's much more ambiguous for the corner cases, or it's much more ambiguous if I tell you, for example, that B doesn't have anything useful to do in the first half of this. You know, if there's information like that, like it's a lot harder to say what's fair. We'll look at that briefly later. And yeah, what a corner case. So fairness is easy when it's like we're comparing things like this. Fairness is not so easy when we're dealing with questions of like, you know, what's fair when B can only run half the time? You know, if B can only run half the time, should B be running less like this, or should B be running equal amount of time overall? Like, that's a tricky thing with fairness, for example. Does that make sense? Yeah?
When you said, like, when B does not have a, do you mean, like, it's in a
system state? Yeah, so I guess, so an example would be, let's say that B, you know, let's say that these were the only times B could run and A could run all the time. Is this still fair? That depends on what you, how exactly you define fairness, right? Because if we think of like, if I only look at like this part of the CPU, if I let B run the whole time and A not run, because that's the only time B can run, whether that's fair or not, you know, you might say no, because we should split up the CPU evenly between everyone who's able to use it. Or you might say, no, overall, B should get the same amount. Does that make sense? So those sorts of conflicts make defining fairness, you know, actually is very nuanced. That's your question? Other questions? Okay, so we'll pick up talking about scheduling metrics next time and look at some simple scheduling policies and how they correspond to the scheduling metrics, and also come up with a name for the scheduling policy X v6 implemented by accident.